Good morning. I'm Ralph Janikowski, and I have the unaccomplishable task of trying to convince you how to create faculty unity, because it's not a destination, it's a goal. But before we get started, I'm the upper school principal at Rockbridge Academy. I came to that after 28 years in the Navy, 28 years in which I felt called by God to be there. And after 2 years in the Pentagon, I felt incredibly called by God to go somewhere else. And that calling led me to Rockbridge Academy, where I've been very blessed to have been a part of raising up the next generation of Christians for the last 3 years. And so I look forward to how God will continue to bless that as we move in the future. So before we get started, let's go ahead and open in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this morning together. We thank you for this opportunity you've provided to us. We thank you for the calling you placed before us. Lord, cause us this morning to guard our hearts, to grow in our love of your Son, Jesus Christ, to inform our minds, and to apply all that we've learned to raise up the children you've entrusted to our leadership. For we pray in your Son's name. Amen. It's a brand new commanding officer. Had just gotten out to Yokosuka, Japan, and taken command of the USS Hewitt, a destroyer. Change of command ceremony was in Saturday morning. The next Monday, we were underway, heading toward Hawaii. Now, we're leaving Japan, heading toward Hawaii. The 7th Fleet, the Japanese Self-Defense Force, and the Korean Self-Defense Force are all going with us. We're going to attack Hawaii. Defending Hawaii is the 3rd Fleet, the Canadians, and the Australians. We are essentially reenacting Midway, from World War II with the various fleets. And so 60 ships are underway. This is 1994. At the same time, Korea, if you remember the time, is developing nuclear weapons, and that tension is underway. And so here you are, part of a great exercise. At the same time, the Koreans are creating great tensions, and they see the fact the United States has 3 aircraft carriers underway, and there are 60 Allied ships all going out and doing stuff. And so the opportunity for me to witness diplomacy and the big stick firsthand was quite remarkable. And so you're part of something great. And so in command of the ship, we went across. We had a very successful 4-week transit there, very successful 4-week transit back. I met my family on the pier for the first time in 3 months. And we had 1 month to get to know one another and say our goodbyes before I deployed to the Pershing Gulf for 7 months. And so at this point, a brand new commanding officer, a successful exercise going on deployment, I am on top of the world. And it's amazing how God has a way of humbling you when you think you've reached your pinnacle. And so we had a long maintenance schedule to get prepared to go to the Persian Gulf. And the first week in port, one of the things we had to do was fix the steam system on the ship that heats all the hot water and heats the berthing compartments. And so after the sailors had all gone to bed, we had arranged to take steam out of the ship to repair some piping and then bring it back in. And when we brought steam back in, we had a steam rupture. And so 150-pound steam escaped in a massive quantity into a berthing compartment where sailors were asleep. And the pipe broke right over the top of one of the chief petty officer's berths. And so immediately the steam and hot water rushed down, hit him, he rolled out of his rack and tried to escape. The phone call I got around midnight told me that I now had a sailor who had second or third degree burns over 80% of his body and was in intensive care unit at the hospital and may not live. So as I came into the ship the next morning, as all captains, when they do come in to work, as they see you walking down the pier, naval custom is to ring the bell, ding, 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 Hewitt arriving. And so instead of the pride I had felt the previous 2 weeks, or previous 2 months, was this humble understanding and complete reliance upon God. The life of that man who was entrusted to my responsibility, at least I thought, was really in God's hands. Whether he lived or died was in God's hands. And there was nothing I could do to impact that. It also was blatantly clear to me is that the rest of the crew was wondering, is this warship, which is an inherently dangerous place, now safe to live on? Can we go to sea for 7 months and live safely, as did the families who also cared about this? And so that was a task of faith. Faith that largely was out of my control. And so it completely reoriented where I was at that point in time and for the rest of my career in the Navy. This humble reliance upon God and the importance of prayer. Prayer and positive action. And so the dual truths of God's sovereignty and man's responsibility were plainly before me right then. And so it drove me to my knees. And the passage in Acts 27, about Paul and his shipwreck became very, very important to me at that point in time, because here's Paul knowing what God's plan is for him, that he needed to get to Rome at the end of his fourth missionary journey to fulfill God's calling. And yet at the same time, here they are in a ship bound for shipwreck with things they needed to do. And so here's Paul orchestrating as a prisoner in chains the actions of the ship and relying upon God. This combined God's sovereignty, man's responsibility, prayer, and positive action. I think for many of us as Christian educators, classical Christian educators, it's important to understand that relationship. And when we ever get out of balance of prayer and positive action, we've erred. And so it's important to, and both are hard work, prayer and positive action. And so I'd like to emphasize that as we get started here, because education, in my opinion, is a team effort. And that a cohesive school where the fruit of the Spirit is exhibited is a team of cohesive teams. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's talk about some of the teams that form our schools. There is a grammar team. There is a dialectic or logic team. And there's a rhetoric team. In the third grade, there's a team. If you have more than one grade, there's a team of third grade teachers. But even within that grade, if you do music, art, PE, there's a group of teachers that form a team working with that group of children that need to maintain similar standards, similar approaches, need to communicate problems. And so the well-run school, that unified school, is a team of cohesive teams that communicate well together. There's also the team of those of you who teach history. That third grade teacher that teaches all those subjects also teaches history that then is going to get retaught to some extent in seventh or eighth grade and retaught again in the rhetoric. And so what gets taught across this continuum of a 13-year K through 12 classical Christian education needs to get reinforced and get talked about. What are those hooks that that third grade teacher is going to start planting in that memory that then they're going to, you are going to, in the dialectic and rhetoric, hang things on that have meaning and substance and value? Those things that the children memorize, sometimes without understanding, that are now going to flower into mature understanding, things that they can use, not only in the classroom, but outside of the classroom. So you have this idea of a vertical team, a horizontal team, and then the team of just being educators together. And all these teams have to function well. All these teams have to communicate for a school, I think, to function properly. So for those of you who think that you're in your classroom with only what matters in your classroom, those of you who think you're approaching it from a lone wolf, as long as I'm good when I'm in front of my kids, that's all that matters, I would argue as the educational equivalent of Luke 10, the description of Martha, who's too busy with her own work to understand the importance of the big picture. And so let's not be educational Marthas. Let's go out and communicate and integrate and do what I think is the difficult work of classical education. We are trying to transfer a way of life. We are trying to transfer how to glorify God, how to enjoy God, and how to take all thoughts captive to Christ. It is hard work. It's fun work. But it requires all of us to work together, that unity that becomes such a hallmark of what we're doing. And as we do that, we are transferring a way of life, we're transferring character. The character of the teacher will be reflected in the character of the student. The student's love of learning, the student's attitudes, the student's perspective will be guided then by the faculty's unity, the faculty's ability to work together. Students are very perceptive. If there is a wedge between teachers, a wedge between teachers and administrators, the students will perceive that, and it detracts from your education because it's not the subjects, it's this way of life, this Christian ethic that you're trying to transfer. And if there's a breakdown in how you deal with one another, there's a breakdown in the education, regardless of how good we teach our individual subjects. And so as the students go through the day, they have the opportunity to evaluate lots of leaders. Each one of you in your role at a classical Christian school is a leader. And the student is looking at you saying, is that who I want to become? Now, we all have different gifts, different inclinations, and that's a beautiful thing for students to be able to see all of us in our brokenness and our different gifts working together to glorify God. And when they see that we have the same purpose and we go about it in slightly different ways, but with this desire to reflect the image of Christ, they see something that's very beautiful, and that's what they'll remember. I'm very fond of talking to my own parents. You know, we don't have our own building. It was so a real blessing last night to go out to Regents and to see their beautiful building. I just go, let's just pick it up and take it with us. But I can't do that. So I don't have my own building, but as I thought about it, I had to try to explain this to my parents. I said, you know, what do you really remember about your high school education? Do you remember about that reel-to-reel movie projector? Do you remember the locker you had? Do you remember the gymnasium and what color the lines were painted? Or do you remember that coach out there who encouraged you? Do you remember that teacher that stayed after school to help you? Do you remember that English teacher that challenge you to read one additional thing and you did it and went to talk to her? It's those people, those educators that you remember. That's what your students are going to remember more than any specific subject that you teach is you and your walk with Christ. That's very humbling. But if we're after unity, that's really where it should start. I would argue then that creating and maintaining faculty unity is essential to the mission of all classical Christian schools. Absolutely essential. And so if we're going to maintain that unity, one of the things we're going to have to do, and particularly we as administrators, is to communicate. And so communication is critical to the success of maintaining unity and therefore to the success of your school. And as you go about communicating, administrators, what I would encourage you is assume that nobody gets it, everybody needs it, and whatever it is, you got to continue to beat the drum. Now, when you have things like vision, that it is very constant. When you have events coming up, they're very specialized. But again, nobody gets it, and everyone needs it, so continue to beat the drum. The fact that the administrator understands what's going on is no reflection of everyone else's understanding. We as administrators often forget that. And so remember who is the audience and what is the message. And so you can over-communicate and have people get lost in verbiage. Another email. And what we don't need is more emails. We need more important information. And so remember your ABCs of communication. Teachers to parents and administrators to teachers and parents. Alacrity, brevity, and clarity, the ABCs of communication. Communicate early with alacrity. Communicate briefly. Keep it succinct so it's easy to digest. And then communicate with clarity. Be precise in your language and in your intended outcomes. And remember, you have two audiences. One is that internal audience of those teachers that you have to talk to and work with. And one is that external audience of your parents. You may deal differently in your language and what you're trying to tell based on who that audience is. And so there are many ways of doing that. Email, phone, person-to-person, groups, letters, websites, newsletters. You got to use all that. And remember then who are you communicating with and do it with your ABCs. It really is important, I think, because we're talking about teachers working together as teams, is that we communicate what's going on in the school. Nothing impresses a student more is when a teacher's informed of what's going on in another grade or another class. Many of your curriculums are organized such that you teach American history and American literature at the same time, or ancient history and ancient literature at the same time. When you can tie those together, when the literature teacher knows what the history teacher is teaching, when you as a grammar teacher can make those points, look at what we just read and remember what we studied in history yesterday, the child begins to see that this really does have meaning and it is applicable. And so suddenly it becomes exciting. This is useful information that I can now take and apply to some other situation. But it's doing what we're commanded to do in scriptures. In Colossians 1, 16, 17, we're required that all things find their meaning in Christ. And so through Christ, all things have their beginning and have their end and have their meaning. And so we should not be surprised when the children are excited by this. They should be created in the image of God. And so all the things we teach, you can't teach everything. So the things you do teach ought to have answer the question of what is their fit and what is their purpose. Fit means you can make some tie-in somewhere else in the curriculum, and the purpose is there's a tool of learning that's going to be applied and practiced through this particular piece of knowledge that you're using. So you choose those things which you're going to spend time on carefully for fit and purpose. While this communication's going on and you're working out these details and talking to one another, sending emails, it's important, and I'm going to say this twice, teachers and administrators who cannot work with one another honestly, openly, and enjoyably have no business working in classical Christian schools. Teachers and administrators who cannot work with one another honestly, openly, and enjoyably have no business working in classical Christian schools. We should all share similar priorities, and that's where that unity comes from. And those priorities, I think, have a hierarchy. To first love the Lord, then to love your children, and then to finally love your subject. All are important, and all should unify us together. A good attitude is far more important, far more valuable to classical Christian education than great credentials, knowledge, or abilities. Because through those 180 days that make up the bulk of our school year, there will be ups and downs, there will be trials and challenges, and it's the good attitude that will allow you as a team to work through it together. And that's what the children will remember, that in the difficult times, you work through it together with a good attitude. And that's very countercultural. No matter where you look outside of our schools, the kids are going to see a different example and a different model. Whether they look to our sports figures, or they look to the news, or they look to entertainment, music, movies, television, it doesn't matter. What they're going to see is people who are arrogant, abrasive, abusive, and self-aggrandizing. The more I can call attention to myself, and the more I can put somebody else down, the better I am. And that is absolutely anathema to classical Christian education, where service is what we're about. And so in the classroom, the other way that this plays itself out with students in particular is apathy. What we like to call at Rockbridge Academy, stupid chic. It's cool not to do well. It's cool to be disinterested. It's cool to kind of pretend like this is way too low for me. And that sort of disinterested apathy is not what God has created or called us to in terms of knowing His wonderful creation. And we need to make sure that students understand that. We need to reflect that through the energy and enthusiasm with which we teach our subjects. And so those are important things. We are countercultural, and we are setting a different example. And you'll see that creep into your classrooms, and when you do, you have to nip it in the bud. And that's for teachers. You may weary of doing that, and call me to come help you. Call your administrator. If administrators are not there to support you in doing that, then we don't have a job. Our job is to make you all better in the classroom, first and foremost. And so use us to help you. And that's what brings me to my next point, which is this is all about service with excellence. It is service with excellence. We are serving others sacrificially. If you need to remind yourself, go back to Matthew 5-7 and read the Sermon on the Mount about going the extra mile, giving a cloak, and proper attitudes. Really is convicting every time I read that. It's very different than, you know, I was watching somebody prepare their coffee down at the book tables, and they got the coffee and then a little bit of cream, a little bit of cream, a little bit of cream. Ah, just right. Okay? When you look at service as cream in your coffee, I got just enough to, okay, good, I'm done with my service, I can get back to my office and do my email. You've got it exactly wrong. Okay? Service is not cream in the coffee. Service is self-sacrificing for others to the point where it hurts. All right? And nobody should ever know it. Prayer and positive action, service to others, is how unity in a faculty is created and, importantly, maintained. But to get there, we all have to have a vision. We also have our eyes focused on a light at the end of the tunnel. And we need to have standards that kind of bound this road as we go down this road together. And so vision and standards are a necessary framework for faculty unity, for school unity. And Doug talked about that in his previous lecture, and I'll get back to that in a second. We as administrators need to set and to monitor those standards. But they can't be this sort of rigid rules. Standards that envision that are optimistic and enthusiastic and passionate, things that have purpose. And they need to be consistent, and there's always a time for an exception, and to make those thoughtfully, wisely, and be able to explain why you're doing it. And then to measure the outcomes. And faculty, you have an important part in this. This isn't just the administrators working. Teachers need to contribute to what those standards are and to what that vision is. Not only contribute, then you have to endorse it and live that out in your classroom. Nothing irritates me more than at the end of the day see a student, we wear ties in our rhetoric and see a student at the end of the day without a tie. You go, where's your tie? Well, I forgot to bring it to school. So why didn't you get one? Well, I said, who's talked to you about it? Well, you're the first one. Now, wait a second. There have been six other teachers in your class all day long, and I'm the first person to say something to it? Yes, sir. Okay, thank you. You're done. I have six teachers I've talked to now. Because we need to work together as a team. And so part of this, if the standard is worthwhile, then let's enforce it. If you don't want to enforce it, let's figure out why that is, and maybe it isn't worthwhile. Maybe three or four earrings is okay for the ladies. Maybe it's not. I don't particularly care what it is, as long as whatever we choose, it has a reason, and then we all decide to enforce it. Paying attention to the details. It's kind of like a garden. You walk by it, you pull the weed. You walk down the hallway, you see a piece of trash, you pick it up. You see a student who's not complying, you stop it. Because if you don't, you've told that student it's okay. And that's what he's learned through your lack of enforcement. Administrators can be particularly guilty of this, but it's a school-wide issue. So I would say have fewer rules, and the ones you do have, make sure you enforce them. Now, students and parents, if you have these rules that are important, you need to explain them to your students, explain them to your parents, and then work to have them adopt them as their own. So that policing is not what you spend your day doing, teaching is. You get past that. People come knowing what the standards are and say, I want to embrace this. And then the parents are looking at the kids are looking at the kids. You know you've won when some other student goes, hey, tuck your shirt in. Or, hey, they have an extra tie down at the school office. Run down there real quick before somebody sees you. Now the students are helping each other. Isn't that really what we want? They've adopted the standards themselves. Very, very important. And as you do this, you begin to get a sense of that Philippians 4, rejoice in all things, rejoice always. Be gentle and anxious over nothing. With thanksgiving, give thanks to God for all these things. And then it's amazing how that peace that Paul talks about
becomes a part of your daily life in amongst all the other things that are going on. We also have our student participate in a service time, and this can play itself out in many ways. During our lunchtime, our Uffel School students serve the grammar school students by taking care of getting the lunchroom cleaned up very quickly so we can use it for PE right after recess. And so the grammar school goes out, and they go to recess doing, well, instead of having teachers monitor recess, I have one teacher out there, and I have a bunch of my upper school students out playing with the grammar school students. I want my upper school students to be role models for the grammar school. They're more likely to follow a 10th grader in doing something than they are following me, because that 10th grader is somebody they know. So I want 10th, 11th, and 12th graders out there with my grammar school students, playing with them, protecting them, teaching them. I also want those students in the classrooms during that lunch period helping the teachers get ready for the coming periods after lunch. And so a lot of our young ladies love to go in and help teachers grade during lunch, math facts and other things that are easy for them to do, to clean the chalkboards, to clean the desk, to arrange something for an afternoon experiment, to help set it up. And so this idea of the upper school students investing in the grammar school teachers and students is very important. And then when they're teaching their lessons, we have some kids who have done some wonderful papers. We'll have our upper school students come down and make presentations as part of the teaching process to the grammar school. This idea of community is built up and down through grades as well as across a given grade. And I want to break that down, particularly because we have two campuses now. And so I have my juniors and seniors who can drive. It's only a short 2-mile drive away. Drive over to the kindergarten classes and read stories during story time. I have students eat lunch with the upper school students eat lunch with the grammar school students to answer questions, to tell them about our grand tour, to tell them about what they did over the summer, to be friends and mentors with them. And so that becomes, I think, an important part of the school community and building unity is when the upper school's kids see that they're having an impact on the grammar school kids. That ties us together. When the grammar school kids go home and say, boy, this was great. One of the 10th graders came to my class today. They really say that. I have parents call me up and say, who was that young lady? I want my daughter to be like her. That is the sort of community we want to build. That's unity. So as you do this, look for ideas and recognize you're going to have to change. As you grow, you will change. Now, all change is not bad. And so the hard part of classical Christian education is determining what to change and what not to change. There are some things that need to be rock, solid, stable as you go through life. There are some things that, in fact, need to be changed. As you get new students and new teachers, you need to reteach things. You need to re-indoctrinate, re-baseline to get people to understand those standards and to love them as their own. Again, this is important. Are you shaping change with prayer and positive action? Because if you're not, the culture, that culture of arrogance and abusiveness and apathy and self-aggrandizement will seep in to fill in the void. Nature abhors a vacuum. And so if you're prayer and positive action, you're going to fill it with the sort of philosophies of classical Christian education, or you're going to allow the culture to seep in. So it's an ongoing battle, and every time there's change, you need to take a look. How am I reestablishing that classical Christian baseline in our school? Administrators, this becomes an important issue for all of us in that we need, through prayer, an unemotional, egoless reflection to evaluate how are we doing. How's our sports team acting? How are we doing in the music class? What about the art class? Have I been there in a while? What teacher haven't I seen teach recently? Have I talked to the parents recently? This constant reflective evaluation along with prayer is an important part of administrators maintaining an even keel for themselves and for their school. As you're doing this, the real danger in today's is the inbox. And when I mean inbox, I'm not talking about the wooden one. I'm talking about the electronic one. We are creatures of, man, I got through all my emails. Isn't that great? Probably not. Because in doing emails, you're not doing people.
People needs to be our passion. We are in the people business. And so, administrators, the emails have to get done. They have to get answered. And so I take a look to see what people emails are there, what teachers need something, what parents have a question. Those are the ones that are a priority. But then I need to get out and be with students and be with teachers. And that becomes incredibly important, or preparing to be with them. Now, every Monday, I do an upper school faculty meeting so we can synchronize the school for that week. And we talk about homework. We talk about tests and papers. We talk about students that are having problems, students that need help, students that have missed class. How are we going to get them caught up? And so we have a very robust meeting of give and take. I prepare for that meeting, and so that preparation becomes an important part of engaging with people. And so administrators, make sure you're preparing for those meetings. And teachers, if you have questions, make sure you're asking them, because sometimes you'd be amazed what the administrator hasn't thought of that you think is perfectly clear. And so that communication, that flow in all situations, I think, becomes very, very important. Oftentimes, administrators, the harder question is, what's not happening? What's not happening? It's easy to watch what's happening, but what's not happening? What should be taught? What do we need to talk about that we're not? That's the question I think that we should spend more time on as we evaluate ourselves. And so as all this is going on, what will interfere with these processes? What will drag unity down? I like to call it anchors dragging on success. Those anchors that destroy the trust of the faculty, that destroy the joy in the classroom, that destroy the purpose and mission of schools. Oftentimes when we have a problem, we blow it out of perspective. We've got to be careful about that. We can overreact. Back in the days of the Soviet Union, we used to call it massive retaliation. We can massively retaliate on a small problem to everyone's disservice. And so we've got to be careful that our problems and our solutions are balanced. You'll get people coming up with lots of great ideas, and they are great ideas, but you got to count the cost of a great idea. How much does it take to execute that idea? And a cost oftentimes isn't a financial cost, but it's in a personnel cost, a time cost, how much effort's required to accomplish it. So it may be a great idea, something to add to a list, but it may not be something that's executable. And so there are some ideas that are good that just need to be recognized as good and maybe later. There are some ideas that need to be executed right now. And the hard work is to figure out which is which and to count the cost properly. Probably the biggest anchor dragging on success at any school is gossip. Teachers talking about students, parents talking about teachers, administrators talking about teachers talking about administrators, in a way that doesn't edify or build up. Now, again, a caution is required here, real wisdom. Are there real complaints about what's going on? Yes. And they need to be raised. There's a difference between a complaint or a critique and complaining. There's a difference between disagreement and disrespect. And to clearly understand those. And so administrators need to have tough skins. Teachers need to have soft voices, and we need to work together to understand what are those issues that we can affect change on in a way that will be helpful. The other thing is sarcasm. The cultural mandate out there is the more sarcastic, derogatory, and humorous you can be at others' expense, the funnier you are. And that's a bad example for us to follow in the classrooms, even when we're talking about people who we violently disagree with. And so I teach a seminar on ideas with our juniors and seniors. I love to get them in, and I love to show them something out of the New York Times and then out of World Magazine and have them compare and contrast the two. I love to go to one of the liberal think tanks in Washington, download an article, and then have them read something from the Heritage Foundation and to compare and contrast. And so for them to get a statement that I read, excuse me, one of the editorials recently, whose Christianity would we teach if we had a Christian nation? Would it be James Dobson or Al Sharpton's? Now, there's so much wrong with that statement that I could spend a whole hour just unpacking that. But we can do a great disservice by making some flippant or side remark about the writer, about either one of the two men, and moving on. What have we taught our kids? To be social commentators in the cultural context, as opposed to unpacking the assumptions, the presuppositions that went into that statement, to understand what the two men really do stand for, and what is classical Orthodox Christianity, and do the two align with it? And then, what was that statement designed to, what conclusion did it want us to go to? I mean, that was said with a very clear, let's get to a certain conclusion, the one I want. What are the conclusions we should draw? And so, we want to teach them to be able to analyze this, break it apart, put it back together, and then winsomely be able to express there may be a better way of thinking about this idea. That's very important. And so this derogatory, sarcastic, unappreciated kind of humor really detracts from the sort of education we're trying to convey to the children. And importantly, educators, the day teachers stop bringing you your problems is the day you stop leading them. They've either lost confidence that you can help them or concluded you don't care. Either way, it's a failure of leadership. So teachers, you need to be fully confident you take problems to administrators. And administrators, if you're not receiving problems, they're out there, something's wrong. And so it's important that continues to go back and forth together, because feedback is absolutely essential in our profession. If you have unity, feedback and communication is a really wide two-way street. And there's lots of traffic on that two-way street. Feedback's how organizations strengthen themselves, support themselves, improve themselves, and it's how you encourage one another. I was very impressed last night with the presentation that Regent School put together. And so, if they were going to do that every year, they'd probably want to meet next week while it's still fresh in everyone's mind and sit down and go, all right, what went right? What were the things we did really well? Well, we had students there, and they were poised, they were confident, they talked well with adults, looked you in the eye. The teachers were in the classrooms were neat, the teachers were enthusiastic, they answered your question, life was in those classrooms with just that one teacher there. They were organized, the literature was all laid out so people could see what they taught, the timelines were up in every classroom, so you could see that they were integrated in how they taught history. The theology books were laid out. You just had this sense of organization. And so there are a bunch of folks at Regents who need to be patted on the back for what they got accomplished. Positive feedback, the value of reinforcing those good things, is really underappreciated. We're very good about negative feedback, but look for the positive feedback, because that is really important to those teachers who last night sacrificed an evening to sit in their classrooms to talk to you. They did us a wonderful service, and I'm very appreciative of what Regents put together for each of us. That sort of feedback session is important for all of us to do after all our events. And then, administrators, you have to ask those probing questions that will kind of, what didn't go right? How can we make this better? And so the idea is, how can we improve? Because when a teacher's contributing to how can we improve, they feel much better about themselves and say, all right, what went wrong? Well, a teacher doesn't want to answer that question. I don't want to be the person saying, you messed this up, boss. But they want to make it better. And so in the process of improvement and asking the right questions, you can do your school a great service. And then people feel as though they've contributed. I helped the administrator make this better next year. I'm better off for it, you're better off, and importantly, the students and the parents have gained from this as well. And so we give, receive assistance, ideas, and changes with patient joy. And recognize that there can be too much going on at one time, and sometimes it's okay for people to hold their hand up and go, stop, slow down. I can't do anything else. I can't do another meeting. And when you hear that scream, it's probably just the tip of the iceberg. And so you need to take a look so that you're not the Titanic running across the ocean with 1,000 things spiraling out of control. And so we need to do what we do well. Adding more is not always better. doing what you do better is really the key ingredient of process improvement. So our orientation ought to be that we're looking for objectives, not obstacles. These aren't obstacles, they're objectives, things we can challenge ourselves with and improve. And administrators, it's good for us to change our mind. It's good for us to get feedback and go, you know, you're right. We could do this better, and I appreciate your feedback. So that requires all of us to show the initiative to admit our faults and a willingness to change course and to take action. And when you do that, it can be great fun, but it takes an administrator who's confident in himself and unafraid to say, you're right, your way's better. Let's do it. And oftentimes it's not that simple. It's more of a synthesis. We need to change something. Here's my plan. Well, from a teacher's perspective, I agree we need to change, but there's a better way of doing it that won't kill me in the process. Well, what is that? Well, I think it'd be better if I did the email that went home rather than you doing it and me having to respond to it. Well, okay. That sounds fine with me. I'm interested in the end game. How do we get the mission accomplished? So this unity, this feedback, this communication are all this wide two-way street that administrators you need to feed and fertilize and cultivate and joyfully receive all that feedback with understanding and oftentimes sympathy. I heard said in several schools, boy, school would be really great if it weren't for the children. Just causes the hair on the back of my neck to stand up. Children are never the cause of disunity. They can be the cause of many other things, but not disunity. And so, in fact, we ought to be unified in our ability to be able to address problems and to carefully respond to those things that children bring to us. Again, it's a people business that requires great patience, energy, and resilience. We must love our children. And they see that, I think, importantly, when you pray with them and pray for them. And so we start every day out at Rockbridge with what we call homeroom. And that homeroom time is an opportunity for us to get announcements out, any changes, any upcoming events, and then to get prayer requests from the kids about what's going on in their lives, to have the older ones pray, the younger ones oftentimes to have the teacher pray for and with them. And it becomes very important because prayer is a form of communication that they need to learn and see this is what real Christians do. And it happens outside of the church environment. And so it becomes meaningful. How many kids, the only place where they see people pray is in church? When you see prayer once a week for an hour, how important is it to you? When you see prayer every morning, when you see prayer before every meal at school, when you see prayer before every assembly, every major event, every major meeting, what does that tell the kids about the importance of prayer? It communicates volumes to them about what a faith, a spiritual life is. And so you're helping the parents now, again, shape and mold the character of this child into that Christian way of life. Students are our business, but parents are our consumer, our sponsor, and our partner. We need to embrace that, love them, respond to them, and unity is part of a community. And that community includes the parents. And so if you're not working actively to involve the parents in as many things as you possibly can at school and to proactively talk to them and continue to energize them, you're not serving the unity of your community well. And so it becomes very critical for all of us to remember that we're doing something countercultural, and parents need to be reassured. Parents need to know that the decisions they've made are right and helpful, and they're raising their child in a way that will cause them to live a life in submission to Christ. I think it's also important that administrators step in and work with and for teachers when problems really do come up, and there are real problems with parents and with students. They happen. There are disagreements. And when the teacher perceives that this is going to be a difficult challenge, the teacher needs to come to the administrator, and the administrator needs to get involved to protect that teacher and to assist that teacher. So when you're sharing problems like that because you want to correct a student and improve a student, that's not gossip. And we need to make sure we understand sharing problems is not complaining if done properly with the goal of shaping the child to become more Christ-like. And sometimes some of the shaping that needs to occur is with parents. And that's an important understanding, that the child may not change until the parents adopt the standards as their own. And so part of this work is working with the moms and dads and communicating openly. Oftentimes we'll find out we're afraid to do that, and when we do it, a parent will go, "You know, I've been seeing the same thing at home. Thank you. Thank you for helping me. How can I support you? What works in the classroom? I want to get after this problem. I want my young boy to grow up to serve others. And right now, all he wants to do is sit in front of the television. How can you help me? How can I help you?" That teaming together often happens, and it happens because some teacher identified a problem in the classroom and had the courage to tell the parents about it and tell the administration about it. So problems are oftentimes important for parents to see because they're harried. Many of them, at least in our neck of the woods, are working two jobs to be able to support sending their kids to school. A lot of them aren't confident. Most are not educators themselves. And so they really are trusting us to come alongside them, partner with them in raising their children. So as this goes on, we come to report card time. The dreaded bane of all teachers. Oh, no, not more work right now. And so we write a lot of report card comments. And I try to convince the teachers that report card comments are not counseling tools. If you need to correct a child, you need to do that before a report card. A parent should never hear about a problem in a report card for the first time. Do not do that. All right? That's the wrong opportunity to try and inform a parent. We got to remember, we who are writing report cards are sinful people. We're writing about children who are sinful people. Those report cards are being read by parents who are sinful people. When you get sinful people writing about sinful people being read by sinful people, the problems for miscommunication there are just rampant. And so report cards, because it carries with a very subjective and objective evaluation of the student, carry a lot of weight with parents. It's not a counseling tool. It should, in fact, be a tool to encourage parents about improvements and about corrections, not how to, at this point, identify a problem. So I think you can be encouraging and educationally honest, but you make sure you use the right tool for the right job. A report card should be an encouragement tool, not an identification tool. And the tone and how you approach this in all communication with parents becomes vitally important. So having talked about all these things, now we got to get to the unity requires gatherings. Now, why did I use gatherings? Because if I had said meetings, you all would have pulled out the big branding iron and put a great big secular on my forehead. All right? But the truth is, we have to have meetings. We have to have meetings. And so why is it that we have such a bad reputation meetings do? And part of it is, first off, people haven't recognized that email passes information, not communication. If I want to communicate with Tim right here in the front row, I want to look him in the eye and I want to talk to him. If I want to pass him information, an email will do that. If I want to talk to him, I'll pick up the phone and call him and talk about a problem. The way to communicate problems is really voice to voice, eye to eye, not email to email. And so we should never underestimate the power of real communications to motivate and to affect change. Real communication being eye to eye, voice to voice. And then we need to recognize that you can't do everything in the meeting. Meetings have purposes. And most schools have three types of meetings: a business meeting, faculty development meeting, and social meetings. All three are important. But recognize what the purpose of this meeting is and keep it to that purpose. Business meeting can be the business of running the school or the financial business. You'll have different audiences there. Faculty development is how do I improve in subject integration, coordination? How do I get the teachers to understand the new math curriculum we're teaching? How do I get them to understand a problem we're having in a theology class that everyone should be aware of so we can improve our ability to understand infant versus believer's baptism and have both groups walk out of the room saying, I am really glad I understand the other side's position. Those are the sort of discussions you need to have in faculty development. And then social meetings. I think it's important if we like each other, let's get together and enjoy one another. And oftentimes some of the meetings we have start out with that enjoyment and never get to the business. So understand the purpose of the meeting, get the business done, and then if there's time left over, you can enjoy one another's company. I think the analogy is very similar to a sports team, football, soccer. The receivers and the quarterbacks practice their routes and throw passes and timing. The goaltenders get together, how do I coordinate the defense and how do we practice skills to block shots? Those sort of individual training things in sports are much like what we should be doing as grammar school teachers or as business people, development people. Their focus is on a specific point when we call a meeting. So I think agendas, administrators, are absolutely essential. If you're going to have a meeting, have an agenda. If your meeting is important enough to have, it's enough to take minutes and record what's supposed to get done when. And then track it. Not to make people look bad, but if it's worth doing, then let's get it done. And so agendas and minutes, very important. And I kind of combine the two. Every upper school faculty meeting I have has an agenda. I write down on it as we go through the meeting, the discussion, what the teachers bring out. And then I go back and I add it into next week's meeting. And so things stay on or leave that list based on what we accomplished during that week. Why do meetings get such a bad reputation? Why do gatherings, if you will, get such a bad reputation? Because they're not organized. Administrators, you've got to be organized. The preparation for a meeting typically lasts longer than the meeting itself if you have a good meeting. Do you stay on track or do you allow rabbit trails to consume your time? Typically, talking about people is a rabbit trail. Talking about issues and ideas is worthwhile. Timely, a meeting to discuss tomorrow night's back-to-school night today is not a helpful meeting. A meeting today to discuss back-to-school night in 3 weeks is a helpful meeting because I can have a meeting now and I can have another meeting to make sure that things are done. So it needs to be timely to help people prepare, and needs to be timely if you want proper feedback. And then you got to arrive on time. I'm furious when I arrive for a meeting on time and the person whose meeting it is isn't there. And so you have 20 people in a room waiting for the leader to show up. He shows up 10 minutes late. Well, how many man hours just got wasted? Let's see, 20 people times 10, that's 200, that's 3 hours. We just wasted 3 hours of faculty time because an administrator didn't get ready on time. That's criminal. Show up on time, teachers, administrators, start on time, get done early. And then if you want to do stuff, you have the time to go do it. So it is an important, this whole have a timely meeting, arrive on time. A good, solid give and take. And then decisions. At some point, you got to make decisions, divvy up responsibilities, and then track the outcomes. Follow-up and completion become an important part of holding a good meeting. But as we do these meetings, there ought to be a clear recognition of loyalty up and down, administrators to faculty, and also a clear respect for authority, a clear respect for what a teacher is doing in the classroom. So when you show up to your meetings, what's the attitude in your mind? Be honest. Are you looking at it as an opportunity to fellowship with co-workers in Christ? When you go to a meeting, are you looking at it as the opportunity to further your fruitful labors in Christ's vineyard? When you walk into a meeting, is your attitude that we are going to glorify God and I'm going to benefit others? If the answer to any of these is not a resounding amen, then you need to rethink how you show up to a school meeting. We are working together for Christ. And so it is important that we have that attitude when we enter into that meeting room, wherever it is. And we ought to be glorifying God with our thoughts and actions and words, as well as blessing one another. Are you building a cohesive, Christ-centered school? Are you building a cohesive, Christ-centered staff and faculty? It's a process. It's not a destination. Every year is going to have new challenges. Every year is going to require changes. Every year is going to require saying the same thing, the same way, sometimes even to the same people. And it's worthy work. We need to be reminded. We need to be encouraged. And we need to make the right changes for the right reasons. We also need to understand we all have our roles and callings. Oftentimes when the board gets together or the administrators get together, we have too many chiefs and not enough Indians. When the teachers get together, we have too many Indians and not enough chiefs. And so both are bad situations. We need to make sure that we understand our roles and our callings. And I think good biblical examples are Exodus 18, where Moses' father-in-law comes and counsels him on he's trying to do too much. Get help. When you get help, trust your help. Let them do their job. When the disciples were ignoring in Acts 6, the work of feeding the orphans and feeding the... Yes, the widows, the orphans and the widows. But that's important work that needs to be done. Somebody needs to do it. Does your headmaster need to do that? No. But somebody does. So who's making sure it's getting done? And how do we divide this task up so that it becomes a combined project that all of us can feel satisfied with our efforts? It's a servant's heart. And a servant also needs to know when to ask to get help. Ask for help when you need it. Ask for help when you need it. There's nothing I enjoy more than setting aside, writing an email, or working on a chart, or whatever I'm doing, to really help a teacher in a classroom, or to help a child through a discipline issue. Responsive responsibility is what I call it. We're all in responsible positions, but how do we deal with that responsibility? Are we responsive to that calling? Proactive problem identification, it's not a problem anymore. Now it's something we can fix. And problems don't go away. Problems don't get better with time. It's not like fine wine or cheese. You know, it doesn't age well. And it lingers. And the children see that. The children see that, and they're sitting there, ooh, I wonder what's going to happen. And when nothing happens, what have you taught that child? Something's wrong. Something's wrong. And so it's very important to understand the students are watching and observing this. I like to call it the 20-10, or the 10-20-70 rule, 20-10-70 rule, because no matter what classroom you walk into, typically what you'll find is 20% of the kids will do the right thing for the right reason regardless. Now, sometimes they'll do it quietly, but they'll do the right thing for the right reason. 10% of the kids are going to try and push the limits. Where are those rules? Did you draw that line there? All right, what are you going to do about it? That 10% is going to be challenging. Not that that's a bad thing. It's the way God's created us. And then you'll have the 70% who's watching those two groups. What do I want to be like? What group am I going to follow? And so you as a teacher, you as an administrator, need to understand that what you need to focus your leadership and your attention on is that 70%. Because where they go is where your classroom goes. It's where your school goes. We will like to focus on the 20% because we think we're just like them, doing the right thing all the time for the right reason. Or we'll like to focus on the 10% and just, I did the right thing. And in the process, we ignore that 70%, those kids who really respond to our leadership, who really want a framework in which to live, whose parents are depending upon us to establish that similar framework to what they have at home. And when that 70% follows the 20% because you're coaching them, nurturing them, helping them, you have one of those beautiful things in a classroom where everyone's learning and growing together in Christ. And that really is what it's all about. This sounds like a lot of work. And so that's why I include the next comment. Teachers are people too. And so as you go through this, you invest so much of yourself. So much energy, so much effort, so much enthusiasm, so much emotion, that it's easy to be drained. And so remember that you have lives, that you have families, that you have problems, and that you have goals as well. And it's okay to talk to your administrators about that. Administrators, it's important that you know that about your teachers. And so if you want unity, care about your people. Care about those co-workers in Christ. Help them. Know what they're doing this summer. Where are they working? Where are they going on vacation? When have you had them over for dinner? Those sort of things are incredibly important, I think, to the unity of a school. That the faculty knows one another, loves one another, helps one another, supports one another. It kind of sounds like something Paul wrote in Corinthians, doesn't it? It's a process of team building. Is your school flexible or inflexible? Is your school imaginative or rigid? Does your school leap for joy when you have new possibilities? Or, it's just more work. I think it's important how we focus on all these things with a joyful attitude. Do we trust our great God? Do we lift our problems up to Him? Are we growing together? Ours is a wonderful calling, and I would encourage you all to never grow weary in doing well and in raising your kids to the glory of Christ. Thank you so much.